Association of Western Pulp.
You know, Sean's personality is one that I have to understand a little bit. But, you know, he's a good heart, so works hard. And I think the AWPPW is going to really hurt you.
Chair notes from some quorum, we're going to start it. First item of business after we return from lunch is the general public comment period, as is noted on the agenda. For folks wishing to make comment, this is for general board topics. Have any wishing to comment? Hey, Chris Mendoza.
Good afternoon, board, and go Hawks. I was late this morning, so I wanted to put myself down for some general comments, not related to Type F, but I signed up as a SEMR member. And mainly I just want to take 2 minutes here. That this morning, I think when I walked in, I heard a lot of discussion, probably heard the acronym SEMR 25 times in discussion about projects, priorities, budget. And as a past SEMR member, as you know, for the past 8 years, the last 5 of which I've served as co-chair, I think it's appropriate to have a SEMR member speak about SEMR. And while I agree there's some efficiencies that can be made at SEMR, I wanted to remind the board that SEMR's already gone through an independent scientific review of our strategy by Stillwater Sciences, where they specifically looked at our research program strategies and provided really helpful recommendations, and we made changes to the program accordingly. They also had a list of policy recommendations that are linked to SEMR research that have yet to be looked at. We also went through the lean process, as you noted earlier. And as Jim and others noted, that one of the main recommendations coming out was to reduce our number of reviews, which we have. I agree with Jim, the jury's still out on that, but I think that as we're moving along, we're getting better. One thing I wanted to point out is that one thing that hasn't been looked at, and I think often gets overlooked, is that SEMR, in that handout you got, has a big list of accomplishments as far as what we've done over the past few years. And concerning human resources, when we are federally funded, our projects come in spurts. We have a low year, have a few projects going. Policy would say, hey, we need to get busier, or we're going to lose the funding. At that time, it was going elsewhere, and we get busier. We add a bunch more projects, and then they have too much information coming too fast, and they'd say, slow down. Whoa, that's too much, too fast, and we taper off. So I think that SEMR as a body has been very flexible and accommodating the ebb and flow of research projects based on So I'm confident that they'll be able to continue to do that, particularly with the senior master schedule and these other deadlines. My personal opinion is that, and I would remind the board of the two issues before them, that both Type F that you're working with now and Type N, which will be the policies working on now that were highlighted by the co-chairs, they were before the board in 2006. In other words, SEMR did all the research that they were tasked to and delivered it to policy and delivered it to the board. And so when independent reviews are looked at, I would, and I've said this before, that I think there's a bottleneck at the policy level that can hold projects up for many years, regardless of whether the research is done or not. And so that's something that I think you're going to have to, I would look into, and the lean operator administrator at the time also made a recommendation on that, because in both cases where we've had reviews, that lens of review has been deflected by policy by choice, by their choice and on to SEMA. So while I'm confident that SEMA can do the work and increase in efficiencies, I would recommend that the board look at the whole other parts of the programs as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. R. Kavanaugh.
Good afternoon, board members. I come before you today to defend my petition for rulemaking for Protect the Western Gray Squirrel. There's been some recent developments that you probably don't know about yet, and I thought I'd appraise you of that today.
This is a general public comment period?
Yeah.
Not a comment period on the rulemaking petition.
Well, just in general then, I'll just tell you that we've learned some more information about the Western Gray Squirrel we didn't know before. And I gave you a handout prepared by some research scientists over at Department of Fish and Wildlife, Mary Linders, and the other researchers over there, one of them is Dr. Matt Vanderhagen. They are research scientists, and their challenge is to find the science behind the species and then turn that over to the operational people who then figure out how to manage it and protect it. Okay? So that hasn't really happened yet. And so where we're going with this is we're going to get the Western Gray Squirrel declared an endangered species, not a threatened species, an endangered species. And then that'll give more emphasis to protect it and manage it wisely. One of the things that we've found is that there's been a policy change in the DNR. And we found that out by reviewing several hundreds, maybe a thousand records going back into the 1993 period. During that period, there was really good cooperation with the DNR and the large timber operators to protect the Western Gray Squirrel. But then when Mr. Goldmark came on, all of a sudden, the protection stopped. Before it was, you could put a condition on the permits. But when he came, that stopped. So all you're agreeing to do right now is to notify Fish and Wildlife there may be a squirrel over there. You feel you have no other responsibilities. Yet when you review Title 222 very carefully, you will see you have many responsibilities to protect the Western Gray Squirrel.
Developing in the petition issues.
I'm just telling you the facts of the issue here. But what we're finding is that the declining population is caused from poor forest practices, procedures, mainly logging and removal of mass trees that the squirrels depend on for survival. That is the principal cause of decline. The counties where the squirrel was once very common, they're absent. So we know that there is a definite decline going on.
I would suggest you present that evidence in a future petition.
This ends phase one, okay? This was the educational phase with you. After this, we're going to use a different technique, okay?
You're free to use whatever techniques you want.
Yeah, I know I'm free to use.
You increased the limit of my forbearance.
Well, your forbearance has not been great, frankly, old chap.
Having no further public comment, we will move to the public comment on the Type FN break. Okay. So, 14 people divided by 10 minutes. So we're gonna push this out at least another 10 minutes or so. We've got a lot of folks who'd like to testify. What I'm gonna do is bring you up in panels, and who I'd like to have first, beginning with Mary Scurlock, Peter Goldman, and Chris Mendoza.
Chair. We noticed the trick chairs here. Do they
have here? Yeah. Careful.
Is there a trap door under here too?
A few times he's just gonna pull it.
I'm watching your foot down there, Aaron. I know where the button is.
Yeah.
I will be extremely brief. I'm going to focus my testimony on responding to this motion. and I have a couple of suggested additions. But other than that, in general, we are supportive of this motion and think that it would be constructive to proceed in this manner. Specifically, I would like to propose that under section one, that we add language. Under I further move, it could go somewhere else, but I'm going to suggest it here. Policy is directed to complete recommendations for options on a permanent water typing rule. I suggest adding the language to identify fish habitat as defined in WAC 010. Secondly, under 1B, I would suggest that we add an evaluation of the current regulatory process to identify off-channel habitat under the interim water typing rule.
Would you say that again? That was great.
An evaluation of the current regulatory process to identify off-channel habitat, just to sort of differentiate between what we're doing and the actual rule, which we're since sort of doing a hybrid implementation there. And then after comma, including recommended clarifications, add or additions to field implementation guidance or rule language. Other than that, I think that we would accept this, that there's a need for further further information about the level of protection currently being provided to off-channel habitat. That information has not been collected. And there's certainly no debate that there is a role for a technical group should additional sideboards on what constitutes off-channel habitat be desired. So with that, I'll defer to my colleagues.
Good afternoon, Board and Chair. I'm Peter Goldman, Director of the Washington Forest Law Center and Counsel for the Conservation Caucus. The Type F issue is properly before the Board for the reasons well stated by others. There's not been a failure of the consensus policy process. It's not been the fault of the participants, and it's certainly not the fault of the lawyers. Let's electrofish the fish, not the lawyers, please.
We'll be the judge of that.
As Chair Everett said earlier, water typing is absolutely key to implementing the regulations. Water typing is a big deal for the Board today because in 2005, the Board made a major direction change in not using the MAPSIS rule, but instead allowing for physicals and electroshocking. And also, we do not have equivalency on its face on the type, the off-channel habitat between type 2 and 3 rivers. So we're here because we're completing unfinished business. As many have said today, the interim rule is underprotective and needs to be improved and made final. It really simply comes down to this, and I know it's all very complicated. Today, there is a rule defining fish habitat. We want to just get there. We want all the implementing mechanisms to just get us to what is the rule today. Fish habitat is habitat used by any fish, any life stage, at any time of the year, including potential habitat likely to be used by fish, which could be recovered by restoration and includes off-channel habitat. We're not casting off to the side the idea of shared risk. All of shared risk is incorporated in how we do that. We just want to get to what the rule says today. There is a gap between the implementing rules and what our target is. And we think the target is not some new rule. The target is what is in the books today. This is in the books. It's 010 right now. So no one failed in any way. The Conservation Caucus, Tribes, Federal Caucus, and some of the state agencies stood shoulder to shoulder in one key way, and that's that the interim rule is underprotective with respect to potential habitat, relies too heavily on electrofishing in some areas, and that more manual guidance is needed to identify fish habitat in the field. We're not making new rules here. We're simply ensuring, we're doing housekeeping here. We're making sure that our implementing rules identify the fish habitat as was committed to in the HCP and as further defined by the Board's rule. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris?
Thank you, Chair. And just of note, if you see the sign-up sheet there, I signed in representing myself, company, and I mainly did that because I wanted to share something that's not as a member of the Conservation Caucus or as a stream typing. Someone's done stream typing for a couple decades. And I just wanted to basically provide my support for number two, that I think on running a LiDAR-based pilot. I know there's folks in the room that have been doing stream typing, Brian Franson, Blake, and others here for some time. And I think that those people that have experience with it on the ground or around the first time we did the model learned a lot based on what a model can do, the limits of it, what it can't do, and how its accuracy can change depending on where you are on the landscape. There's no question that had we had this tool available to us, LiDAR, back then, we would have had a much better product. And I guess in that regard, we're very fortunate to have that technology come along to where it is. So I think this effort would be a worthwhile effort to, not precluding how you would use the end product, but that that would, in fact, I think, shed light on where a lot of these streams are, and in just in itself have the potential to reduce the amount of electric machine based on knowing where and where not to go. Where you have that, those likely endpoints of fish distribution. And then lastly, also, I think as the chair made a note here, that there are other people that have already begun to start to explore this, looking at hydro layers that are LiDAR-based. State Land's done a little bit of work on it, as noticed here. I know that the University of Washington has also, a few years back, had a grad student that had done some work with LiDAR as well. So I support, I think this is a good idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, let's have Norm Schaaf, Tim McBride, and Blake Burton.
Good afternoon, Chairman Everett, members of the board. Thank you for letting us testify. I'm Norm Schaaf. I'm the Timberlands Manager for Merrill and Ring in Port Angeles. As has been pointed out in comments earlier, the model that we've been hoping would be successful has not been effective, and the maps have often been stated as being inaccurate. And that leaves us very little choice as landowners but to go out and utilize other means to verify whether or not fish are really present. We're required, of course, to protect the streams if they meet physical characteristics, unless we can prove that those streams are not occupied with fish. So it leaves us very few choices. But let me talk a little bit about the protocols and the way in which this is done. First of all, when our stream surveyor goes out, and he's a qualified and certified to conduct this work, he verifies the physical characteristics of the stream. In other words, if it's not meeting the habitat characteristics, you know, then it makes a different decision. But assuming that those characteristics are there, he then looks for fish. He doesn't just stick the electroshocker right in and see if something comes to the surface. He looks, and often you'll see fish. And if that's the case, he will move on upstream to the point at which the stream characteristics change to a point where he's thinking fish are probably not going to be present. That's where he starts doing electroshocking. So this is not doing a census of an entire stream. It's a very limited use of a tool in order to observe, hopefully, that last fish point. Once that point has been established, of course, then he has to go upstream again further to the next habitat break. And that's where the type FN line actually gets proposed to be put on a map. Then that goes to the water type modification group within the Department of Natural Resources. That includes all the regulators and all the stakeholders for approval. So this is not a unilateral decision, but it's something that all of the stakeholders are involved in and approve. And only then is something established and put onto a map that we can utilize. In all the times that we've been doing this, can't think of a single instance where we've actually been able to move the type FN line down. It's always been up further than where the mapped location was on any of the DNR base maps. So we are, in fact, resulting in greater amounts of protection than what the maps would indicate. I encourage the board to support the motion. As it is up there, there's probably a few modifications that will be made, so I won't say verbatim. But I can support it, certainly, in its general terms. And I appreciate the identification of the need to go out and collect some more data to inform the process, to continue to work through it with all the stakeholders. Mr. Bernath and Mr. Peters both suggested that things get solved a lot better when we get out into the field. I support that, and I encourage board members and all those involved in the process to do that. Lastly, on LIDAR, very quickly, it makes a very great topographic model. It doesn't say if there's a fish in the stream. It doesn't even say if there's water in the stream. So there will still need to be field verification. LIDAR is going to be a good tool. It will not be the end all. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Everett and the board, for the opportunity to share my professional perspective today regarding electrofishing. I'm Dr. Blake Merton, Director of Wildlife and Fisheries for Port Lakeley Tree Farms, and for the past 15 years, I've worked in the Pacific Northwest conducting stream surveys, which includes the use of electrofishing. I'd like to share with you how Port Lakeley conducts stream surveys and how we utilize electrofishing as one of our tools to classify streams in Western Washington. But before I walk you through a typical stream survey, I want you to know that we have both a state and a federal scientific collection permit. We take these permits seriously and the conditions of these permits. We follow the electrofishing protocols and guidelines established by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the National Marine Fisheries Service. Streams are visually inspected first, as Norm mentioned, and electrofishing is only used to confirm presence or absence when no fish are visually observed. In addition, we only survey those portions of headwater streams where fish occurrence is uncertain. Because we are not attempting to quantify a fish abundance or species composition, we have no need to handle or measure the fish that we observe. The stream portions we survey typically contain very few fish because they are associated with the very upper limits of their distribution. So when fish cannot be visually observed, we employ electrofishing, which is the most accurate and scientifically sound method available for demonstrating fish presence or absence in headwater streams. The characteristics of small streams generally do not lend themselves to other methods such as trapping or netting, hooking line, or snorkeling. Thus, electrofishing is the method of choice used by fisheries biologists for determining distribution. Once we have verified that that stream is fish-bearing, it will forever be classified a type F stream. The point here is that we are not conducting annual multi-pass surveys. We're encountering only a few fish, and these surveys are conducted only once. All of our stream typing data is submitted to DNR and available for review by members of the TFW caucuses, and ultimately available to the public via the DNR FPAR system. In my 15 years at Port Lakeley, our company has upgraded far more stream segments to type F than we have downgraded type N. However, regardless of how many have gone one way or the other, our priority is simply to get it right. This is foundational how individual streams should be protected or what resource protection measures need to be applied to those streams. We need the ability to continue to collect site-specific data if we want to accomplish this goal. In closing, my professional opinion and experience that Port Lakeley's use of electrofishing has not resulted in significant mortality, nor had negative effects on resident or listed populations. Over the past 15 years, our mortality rate has been less than 0.04% based on an estimated encounter rate per mile of stream survey. Proper use of e-fishing settings provides for a high level of fish detectability and low level of injury to fish. Banning the use of the valuable method of sampling will remove an important tool for biologists and would be analogous to taking away a carpenter's hammer or a forester's D-tape. We believe science should lead the way, so if there are concerns about e-fishing, let's look at the current methodology and data to identify if and where the issues are and address those. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about stream surveys, or better yet, I invite you, any of you, or the entire board, to just come out and see for yourself how we conduct stream surveys and employ e-fishing techniques. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm Tim McBride. I represent Hancock Forest Management. We manage over 700,000 acres in the state of Washington. We interact probably with every single DNR region that's out there. I've been managing the water typing program for Hancock since I started in January 2003. For a number of years, we tracked our approval rating, interact with Don Naur a lot of you know Don Naur, he's been to the board here. And we came up several years in a row, we came up with an approval rating of over 92% the second time around, or let me back up and say the first time submittal of watertight mods. And those other 7 or 8% have always been negotiated out in the ground, you know, once we got out there and had an ID team. So we're looking at generally a 99.9% approval of our watertight modification proposals that we submit. And we do this by using the current protocol that's in Section 13 of the board manual. We know that section very well, backwards and forwards. We've developed a much more intense program based on the guidance that's in there, because across our 700,000 acres, we interact with streams that are generally 5 feet wider. You need a very specific protocol that's agreed to by all of the representatives within your area of influence, and we do that, and we get that programmatic survey protocol approved every year before we go out into the woods. 1 year using that protocol, we decided to summarize our results of what 1 year based in our area of calf lambent resulted in, and over 100 different surveys in that area in 1 year. We were generally over 400 feet above the nose of the last fish with our FN breakpoint. So we're not sticking to what's the interim or whatever. We're going out there and doing what's right by using the protocol. We're finding the end of habitat. But we're doing this with expert people who have been trained for a long time using the protocol. And what I've seen, I cut my teeth on electrofishing back when Bruce Baxter from the Quinault tribe was running some of the validation tests back in the 90s. And I learned from him and generally took his training every year. We haven't had training in this state for electrofishing for at least 10 years, right? Now, I know it's supposed to go away, but as Blake said, as Norma said, being on the ground using this electrofisher is the only way in certain sites to find the end of fish habitat. So I think it's high time that we reenact and kind of conduct the training. But I would stress that we need qualified people, actual practitioners of the tools that we're using to conduct this training. So reach out to us, to contractors and things like that that are doing it. Also, I would say that in our reports, we've been told that we set the platinum standard for reports back to the DNR. Sometimes our reports are 27, 30 pages long. Provides a lot of data. As Blake mentioned, they can tell you how many fish that were actually impacted fatally on all of their surveys. Well, that data about the numbers of fish that we encounter and all of that, that's there. And I think by spending a little bit of time summarizing that, you're gonna be able to answer how low of an impact electrofishing actually has on many of these fish, and even what kind of species that we encounter during our surveys. So I would just say the current tool works. And as you've heard many times from many of us, data is important. And so concerning the board motion that's on the board, in the first part, it's kind of ambiguous as to whether policy may accomplish these tasks by using technical. I would hope that you stress that they should and shall use technical groups to really get to a resolution in this process. Thanks.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's next have Kevin Godbu, Adrian Miller, Aaron Terwilliger.
I'll go ahead and get started here. I'll be very brief. I wanted to first of all thank the generators of said motion, whomever they are, because I think it does an excellent job in addressing many of the shortcomings that Stephen and I were discussing in terms of boundaries and specificity. Specifically, I think water typing, electrofishing has been well expressed in terms of the importance there, but I did want to touch on 1B in terms of the importance of this motion focusing on off-channel habitat. From my company's perspective, we believe that both the case of electrofishing and in the case of off-channel habitat, when you actually get out on the ground and apply these as they are prescribed, we are meeting the rule. And I want to make it very clear to all board members that I think my landowner and other landowners do actually protect off-channel habitat. I would agree that how that is defined is often really worked out in the field. And I think by doing the process that is being outlined here, if we identify situations where there are vagaries in how that is established in the field, that there will be an opportunity then to correct that and provide some guidance. But again, I think it's going to be limited, if any. And that, I'll end my testimony.
Good afternoon, board members and Chair Everett. My name is Kevin Godboy. I'm with the Weyerhaeuser Company. I'm going to try and go between broader picture and then the motion. But you know, the reality is it's been 10 years since we've had a technical work group working on water typing issues. And I think you were asking the question, how did we get here? Well, this is what happens when we have data-free analysis. When you take a tough subject and you throw it to a bunch of policy folks and say, come up with an answer and there's no scientific support, you're not going to get a well-baked cake. And so I think it's really time as we think going forward to either reinvigorate ISAG or to think about appointing, you know, a real blue ribbon group of qualified and competent and objective scientists to work on the broader issues. We just can't have the same people showing up arguing the same things and expect different results. We know what that's called. So, you know, it's really time to reinvigorate the science, and we have a tremendous amount of data that's been collected, and I do think that that's the option going forward. This system has been in place for nearly 20 years. We survey over 500 streams a year. Almost 99.9% of them go through the process, much like all the other companies. You know, we're not going to the last fish. We're looking at, you know, physical factors on the ground above that point. So I don't know if there's really a problem here. And although I support working on the motion, I also think that there's an assumption that electrofishing is a problem. We don't have any data to support that. I mean, we're taking an action here today based on sort of people's opinions, but no one's brought any data forward to show that there's actually a problem. So I think through this process, you know, we'll probably be able to demonstrate that the current protocols work, you know, quite well, and it's all being done relative to what the board has done in the past and what's necessary for the ITP. I will mention a few things on the motion to think about. Under the IA, where we talk about developing best practices, and there's language in here about an evaluation of published literature, that might be necessarily constraining. I think there's a lot of gray literature or other external information that we probably want that work group to look at, and then you might want to think about the language associated with ISPR review in the CEMA adaptive management process that recognizes that there's, you know, a sort of a body of relative scientific information. So I just caution that if we just look to published literature, we're going to have a lot of debate about what's published and what's not and what's good and what we can't look at, and we'll be right back where we were on policy. So a little flexibility there. And then the other issue about we're trying to minimize potential site impacts, and I think we have to be take the word of caution. I think we heard from Fish and Wildlife Service is that we're trying to limit impacts to ESA-listed fish. And that a lot of the surveys where we are doing work is in the upper extent of headwater streams with no ESA-listed fish, maybe even fish that have gills but don't necessarily swim that far. And so I think, you know, we want to keep our focus on, you know, the constraint of potential ESA liability, which I believe is very minimal to non-existent. And then back to a point that Tim McBride made on the motion that talks about policy may accomplish these tasks. I think you got to say shall accomplish these tasks with the formation of technical work groups and subgroups. I think if we're left to our own, it may not, you know, we might not be able to get the information. And I think, you know, even for these first couple of tasks, trying to get some folks that are practitioners that have technical experience, forming kind of the technical basis, and then having policy set some sideboards is the best process forward. And that's what we tried to do during sort of the dispute resolution, was looking at these issues of saying, you know,
policy aren't the scientist here. What we need is the framework, much like the board will set the framework now. But then you've got to let the technical people and the scientists go out there, and I don't think we want to constrain them so much that we can't use, you know, all relevant and available data and information. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Everett and members of the board. Again, my name is Karen Tulliger from Washington Forest Protection Association. Thank you for the opportunity to chat with you for a few minutes about water typing. I think my colleague here just told me that policy lawyers don't know how to bake. And so, and so I've got two pieces of information for the board. First, some testimony that I prepared, written remarks that are general remarks that I have copies for the board. I also was interested in listening to Jim Peters' discussion and found in my my files a primer that was put together on the TFW process called the TFW Agreement and Introduction. And I'm gonna give Patricia this copy so that she can also give you guys all a copy of this. In this book, it talks a lot about the TFW process as well as those very basic ground rules that Jim talked about earlier. So just for brevity, I wanted to cover three individual points. First, in terms of the Forest and Fish Report and the Habitat Conservation Plan, I think it's a really important step to be able to focus the attention of policy in this discussion and through the motion that you're putting together. But I just wanted to remind you that it is a package deal, and there are several components of this that will need to be looked at as we go down the road. And in that light, the suggestion that Mary made to identify fish habitat is the habitat that's defined by 010, that's WAC 2221610. We can't support that request, primarily because the concept of fish habitat is much broader in the FFR, the Forest and Fish Report, and the Habitat Conservation Plan, and it encompasses actually three elements. One is a description of habitat, which is what Mary talks about in that definition of 010. Secondly, there's an effectiveness or efficiency level in terms of the 95% effectiveness. And then the third element is really a concept of shared risk. So that's we wouldn't support that concept of putting that language in. Second point I just wanted to make and reiterate is that it is absolutely essential for good data to be used in this process and science to really formulate the basis of these rules going forward. And then finally, I think focusing policy's attention on this area is really important. I agree with Peter that there has been a lot that has happened at policy in the past year. Policy has looked at two major rules, a mass wasting exercise, budget process for CEMA as well as a work plan, a review of the HPA program, and then a new way of interacting between CEMA and policy. And I think all of those things together made the workload for policy over the past year extremely difficult and challenging. And going forward, looking at this issue is really important to focus. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
You bet.
Chair, I guess, your comment about 010 language, and I'm trying to understand my reaction is if we don't go in with an agreed to definition about what we're talking about, we're setting ourselves up for failure again. And so are you saying that's already in WAC 010, so it's a given, but you're saying that the parameters that were put forward in the Forest and Fish Agreement need to also be carried along with it? Is that?
Yes, in the resource objective in the Forest and Fish Report and the Habitat Conservation Plan, it actually has three elements. The first element is that descriptor of habitat. The second element is this concept of high efficiency or high accuracy, which I think is critical in this process, whether or not we're using a model or another method. And then the third is this concept of sharing the risk or balancing the error. All three of those components are important. And one way to address this issue instead of citing specifically to 010, maybe to cite to the resource objective in the Habitat Conservation Plan and FFR, because that brings all of those elements in together.
One other element to think about is in the, and Jim Hopp had mentioned it this morning, that the rule actually talks about in section 030 in water typing about the fish habitat water type maps. It doesn't really reference fish habitat. It's a subtle difference, but That gets at the fish habitat definition is a complex paragraph of two sentences, and it talks about the method by which fish habitat shall be determined is the model. And so when you go back into the rules about how you define that on the ground, you're not really finding fish habitat. What you're doing is implementing the map model results. And so in some respects, in my personal opinion, fish habitat is an orphan definition that doesn't directly relate to the fish water typing system, because we reference the fish habitat water type maps. So you have this subtle difference in which fish habitat may, some of those objectives about restoration may be achieved through our maps and through modification and opening up channels. So it's a kind of a complex definition that gets into a lot of parts of the HCP and the rules.
Welcome to Forest and Fish Policy.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking.
other questions? Sorry, you asked.
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm here at all.
We can rectify that as much as possible. Thank you. Next, let's have Kurt Velhuizen and Jim Peters.
Good afternoon. I'm Kurt Velhuizen. I work for the Skagit River System Cooperative, which is a tribal organization that represents the Swinomish and Sauk-Suwannal Indian tribes. Do you want Jim to introduce himself?
All right.
Okay. Let's see. So I've been involved in the forest and fish process for 14 years, and water typing is obviously a big part of what our program does. I've also been involved through the policy committee in CEMER in the past, but I'm really going to focus on what goes on in my home basin of the Skagit. Basically, the water typing process has worked quite successfully, and I can echo some of the things I heard from various landowners, in that we have made things work. Working with landowners who have used very competent people in the field and provided some good work, and we've reviewed those things, and basically it's worked quite well. Now that's the success. The challenge is that we've been working with a board manual and guidance that's over 10 years old at this point, and basically the state of the science has moved way ahead of what the guidance specifies, and we're increasingly finding that what we're going back to in terms of documentation is we're starting to feel that it's quite inadequate. Basically, we've moved way beyond it, and the concern that we have is that in some cases, again, we've sort of outgrown the existing documentation, and now we're in a position where we're starting to see some evidence that some folks are wanting to go back and anchor back into the old information, and that's creating some stresses between kind of where things have evolved versus what's actually written down. And that's why our view is that there is a pretty urgent need to, first of all, resolve some of these underlying broader issues that have been brought up earlier, to update the board manual, and to create a permanent rule. So we have that to have all folks' work be based upon. So that's my main point. As a secondary point involving the motion, I think the two components of Section 1 both have significant merit in my mind. Rerunning the model based on LIDAR is something that I cannot support, because the model was a terrible failure in the North Cascades region where I worked before, and I think most of the landowners I deal with would probably be right here with me agreeing with that. Partly because in our glaciated landscape, there's a lot of reasons why fish are certain places and not in others. Some of it has to do with barriers and topographic things, and some of it has to do with groundwater. People carrying fish around in coffee cans, a variety of ways that fish get from point A to point B. So we're not convinced that that putting additional resources into a tighter model is gonna get us to a usable product. We found that the cumulative value of surveys is sort of where we think that we'll get the best overall documentation where type F waters are. So we would support that. We recognize other parts of the state may have different landscapes that might benefit more from that, but I don't think you'd find much enthusiasm in the North Cascades.
Thanks. Jeff?
Good afternoon. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be in front of you guys. My name is Jim Peters, Northwest Indian Fish Commission. The Westside tribes believe that the rule is adequate somewhat, you know, and I'm following up with some of the other people that said what they said. However, the current interim rule, there are some issues with the implementation of it. And part of that could be solved by just getting DNR together with the stakeholders process to deal with the board manual and spelling some of that type of stuff out so that it's easier to implement into the field. Street typing is very important for us. It's important to protect salmon habitat where the fish are using today, and then also what as the runs start to recover, where they're going to be able to go to. And then some of that is man-made blockages or natural blockages, but they're still physically are able to get up there. And it might be just because of the stocks are struggling right now, is that's why they're not using that habitat. So we do need to protect those in those areas. And then, like always, what we try to do is any rule changes need to be based on science and support those rule changes with those. In closing, I would like all of us to consider looking at our administration of the stream typing of the administration of the stream typings, and looking at Department of Ecology or a blend of agencies that implement this, because right now DNR focuses on forested lands, and we got a lot of lands out there that aren't being covered with stream typing, and there isn't the field verification or the mapping that's occurring out there on counties, cities, and ag lands, and we do need to be able to make sure that everybody is utilizing this stream typing system correctly. With that, I want to thank you for your time, and good luck.
Thanks. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. And finally, here we have Harry Bell and Elaine O'Neill.
Aaron, I didn't sign up for
the team. Were you intending to sign up for the general?
No.
Okay. Well, then just Elaine.
Works for me. I'm Dr. Elaine O'Neill. I'm representing the Washington Farm Forestry Association. It's a group of small landowners as opposed to the large landowners. And we're actually I'm relatively new to this position. And we're also relatively new as members of the policy committee. We have a new member on the policy committee. I think as of October, November, that's Dr. Dick Miller. I think fundamentally there's a few particular, essentially this looks good, this motion as read, it looks pretty good to us. There's a couple of things to point out for small landowners. We don't have millions of dollars to do electrofishing. And neither can we necessarily rely on a map. I've had quite a bit of experience with MAPA. I've also been a professional forester for a good number of years. And then the other thing that I've done is an enormous amount of data-intensive analysis and research. And so when I think about the way to approach this and this idea of using a model to develop a map as rule, I'm concerned that that my constituents have that option to be able to ground truth that rule. Models are a funny thing. In the peer-reviewed literature, you can get, explain 43% of the variance, and that's good for some of these models because of the complexity involved with them. So the opportunity to use some of these tools, improve on the tools, I love the idea of using LIDAR to improve on where you can start looking. I have actually looked at LIDAR relative to existing maps, done some comparisons in the field, and said, well, you know, it's maybe a little better assessment of where to look, but it certainly doesn't tell you where that fish and non-fish position would be. So in closing, I just want to keep it very brief. In closing, my caucus essentially says, I like the form of this. There's some specific wording that may need to be worked on, but basically the idea of more data, better data, and use data to actually inform the process. Thank you.
Okay, that concludes public comment on this action item. So who wants to kick us off here?
Chair, can I just make one announcement? The cafeteria has a purse. Somebody, you're missing your purse? Cafeteria has one.
Okay.
Sorry, thank you.
That's mine. So do I have a person brave enough to sit here for the 3 minutes that it's going to take to read this motion, so we can get ourselves started on whatever amendments we need to make?
Do we have to read it?
Right, so.
I'll read it.
Very well. We have a second. Motion's been made by Carmen and seconded by Mr. Gunther.
But you're going to read it, right?
Proceed to reading.
Okay. I move the Forest Practices Board initiate actions to remedy the Type F water concerns outlined in the majority and minority recommendations of the TF Living Policy Committee caucuses by obtaining additional information and directing additional work by policy. These steps are essential for the board to consider making a final determination of the appropriate approach to take in the development of a permanent water typing rule. I further move the board and policy work plans be amended to reflect the following. Number one. Policy is directed to complete recommendations for options on a permanent water typing rule, beginning with two tasks to be completed and reported to the board at the May 2014 meeting. A, development of best practices recommendations regarding protocol survey electrofishing, including an evaluation of published literature, minimizing potential site-specific impacts, and options for reducing the overall extent of the survey's use. B, an evaluation of the process to identify off-channel habitat under the interim water typing rule, including recommended clarifications in field implementation guidance or rule language. The evaluation must be based in part on field review of approved forest practices applications and water type modification forms. Policy may accomplish these tasks through the formation of technical subgroups or other means as needed to complete work by the established deadline. Number two, the Adaptive Management Program Administrator is directed to work with board staff and others as needed to scope and initiate a pilot project to rerun the existing hydrologic model using LIDAR data, including at least two watersheds, one west side and one east side. The administrator shall make optimal use of contract resources, persons involved with the original development of the model, and LIDAR analytical frameworks completed in development by DNR State Uplands. The objectives of this effort are to A, develop quantitative information about the footprint of the interim rule as applied, B, compare model-based water type designations to on-the-ground forest practices applications and water type modification forms, C, investigate additional model utilities such as detection of off-channel habitat, ability to predict physicals and assess footprint effects from using different physicals, i.e. its ability to provide analytical and or implementation value to different options for approaching the various issues raised in the water typing rule dispute memos. D, provide information that can inform the board's basic administrative choices among map as rule versus guidance map with field adjustments. The board authorizes the administrator to utilize up to $100,000 of forest and fish support account funding to enter into contracts as needed to scope and initiate work before the May 2014 board meeting. The pilots are to be completed by the August 2014 board meeting. The administrator will present a progress report at the May 2014 board meeting, including an estimate of the total funds needed to complete the work directed above.
Well done. Thank you very much. So we had a couple of references to what I consider to clarifying edits in the comments, and I'm sure there are a couple others of those that have bubbled up over the lunch period. So let's take those in a batch if we can. discuss them, and then maybe we can just do one motion to amend and then a motion to approve. And if we have anything that is not controversial, we can discuss that separately, okay? So I heard, in that realm, I heard an evaluation of published literature. The term published might be, I don't know, stricken or something, to make that a little broader.
Substituted to relevant.
Relevant?
As determined by policy.
I think that's a helpful clarification. We talk about all kinds of irrelevant things.
So relevant literature? Yeah. It's determined by policy.
Okay, so that's one tweak there. Other ideas about that change before we move on?
Well, I just point out that both of those definitions, A and B, use the word including. So it's not an exclusive list.
Correct.
So yeah, they can include
irrelevant.
Yeah, they can include irrelevant stuff.
Mr. Chair, do you want to, are we just addressing ideas that came from the public, or do you want...
Yeah, let's try and... Patricia, if you can back that out and make the trench changes and track changes so folks can follow what we're doing here on the clarifications. Thank you. And Paul, I'll apologize to you on the phone. This will be a little hard for you to follow.
I'll do my best. I'll ask questions. I'll give options if I need to.
I look forward to it. Mr. Somers?
There was a clarification on 1B, an evaluation of the current process. It just it reads a little clearer to me. I think it's there, but that current, under 1B, an evaluation of the current process.
Current rule process.
Current regulatory process.
What we're referencing there is current rule.
Yes.
So let's say that's what it is.
Okay.
Are you about to ask me concern with that change? Okay. I heard down under the bottom statement, policy shall accomplish these tasks through the formation of technical groups or other means, which is also a permissive statement. So, you know, a symbolic change perhaps.
Shall is stronger.
Okay.
So still, yeah. Could I have a suggestion in 1A?
Yeah.
Or, instead of reducing the overall extent of the survey's use, Bridget had some language on her second page. Protocols will ensure the lowest impact to ESA listenership.
Clarifying and wrapping in the services.
Options for reducing the
impact.
Yeah, striking, reducing the overall extent and switching it to ensuring the lowest impact to ESA listed fish.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a little bit of more than a clarifying change, so let's come back to that one in a minute if we can.
Sure.
Okay. Other clarifying changes? It seemed like there was one other from some of the feedback we got.
Strike number two.
Yeah, I don't think I can go along with that.
Well, there was a suggestion about using the current definition of habitat, but we need some probably discussion.
Let's come back to that one. So we've got two, this one on the overall extent issue, and then the definition of habitat issue, which was pertaining to that first clause under the policy part of the motion. So those are two that we need to come back to in a minute. Any other wordsmithing?
I don't have detail, but I have some questions.
Okay. So if there isn't any more wordsmithing, let's have a motion to amend or a proposed amendment to encompass the track changes that
we
made here.
I move to amend as shown on the track changes.
So much screen made. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. 2 seconds. Let's say Mr. Stanley got in just in front of you.
All right.
So the motion was made by Mr. Somers, seconded by Mr. Stanley, to accept the track changes that we just put up on the board. Is there discussion on that?
Could you reread the motion?
as amended?
Okay, hearing no further discussion, let's have a vote on the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 No, say no. Abstentions? Okay. So technical changes made. Got two substantive things to deal with now. The first of them was the suggestion up under sub 1 that we specify what we mean by habitat in terms of current rule definitions. And as we saw from the discussion that ensued on those on that issue, you know, I think the intent of our drafters was to recognize that those are still unresolved issues in policy, exactly how we're able to talk to one another about that distinction. And therefore, because we didn't succeed in reaching a sort of an agreement in principle around those things, the policy is being directed to complete two tasks. And so the board's direction here is simply that we need a permanent rule, and that these are the first two tasks the policy needs to complete on its way to a permanent rule. So is there
so
a discussion on
given that, I'm suggesting we think about how to advance that conversation or the resolution of that issue in parallel with these activities. And it's critical to get that nailed down and get some direction. And maybe that's a role for a special work group of this board, or I don't know. But it's been bounced around for so long, and you can see the interplay of forest and fish and the rules and the rest of it. But if we don't resolve that, we're not actually going to move forward, even if we accomplish these two tasks. That's my concern.
No question. I think you know, what we're trying to do here is grab some of the near-term things that can maybe shape the discussion loose a bit, put some quantitative information around the nature of different changes that could be contemplated within policy and ultimately the board, in the hopes that that begins to give us a better frame of reference or close the frame of reference, the gulf in the frame of reference around the meaning of resource objectives and issues like shared risk and so on and so forth. I haven't seen anything out of policy at this point that leads me to believe even if we assigned it,
no,
there would be able to be a good on it without first trying to make some progress on some of these individual tasks. And that's the reason to I would urge us to leave it as a That's my sense. Fair enough?
Yeah, it's still hanging out there to me. I'm not making a proposal to amend, but you know, I do think I would like to see us at least figure out how we're going to progress on it, or maybe talk about it after the motion a little bit if there's any ideas. But
and the board for you all should feel grateful and happy to know that the board's going to need to spend a considerable amount of time on water typing, including those issues.
Well, if we can talk about time for a minute.
Can we hang on for a second before we leave this this point of inserting a reference to the definition of fish habitat?
Sure.
Forgive me if this sounds a little bit too naive or common sense-ish. But if we were to put that sort of qualifier in the first paragraph and maybe not now in the second paragraph, that just clarifies that the development of a permanent water typing rule that identifies fish habitat as defined, blah, blah, blah. I don't understand why it's so controversial to refer to a definition of fish habitat that's already in the rule. It's not, to me, it doesn't, it's just anchoring what the rule is supposed to accomplish. It's not precluding, you know, addressing the idea that there's going to be a little bit of error on one side or another. It just seems to clarify things, to have a reference to the definition of what we're trying to actually type. We're trying to type F. Shouldn't type F be equivalent to definition of fish habitat that's in the rule? So I guess I'm a little bit perplexed as to why it would be such a big deal to add that reference.
I think the short answer, Paul, is that policy has been arguing about that for 3 years, and what we're trying to do is move ahead on some specific things that we think we can maybe accomplish in the near term, and puts in a particular set of Well, in addition to the quantitative understanding of what we have from sort of comparison from current practice, and it's that fundamental misunderstanding among the caucuses about what the meaning of those terms are that brings the dispute to us. So I think all the motion is saying is we're going to resolve that and other issues. We're going to begin resolving that and other issues with these two specific tasks for policy. It's not to take them off the table or to undercut them or any of those things, but that we're acknowledging that folks are at an impasse over principal level discussions about what they think those commitments were. It's not that the board isn't going to resolve them.
Right.
It's simply that we're giving task direction to policy.
Okay, thank you.
One other question regarding electric fishing, and I guess let's be clear that I understand it. Is the federal ESA issue more relevant on obviously public lands, private lands? Is the electrofishing issue different on private lands than it is public lands because of the HCP?
I don't think there's a difference.
Okay.
It's simply that the practice in question is within the regulatory purview of the board, which is not federal.
So would it be fair to read the motion in light that we are going to explore exactly what those, I think Bridget talked about the two lines, stay within the lines, and at least with electrofishing, it's not real clear to me what those lines are, and that's a critical question because that's going to define to the extent electrofishing is on or off the table or useful as a tool or not or how limited it is. So maybe we can just have that understanding that that's part of what we're looking at with the electrofishing issue.
Yeah, I think the folks have covered the resource objectives of the HCP and the Forest and Fish Agreement well, and one of those is this maps rule concept. And at the same time, we've heard valid reservations about whether MAP as rule is a practical thing. So if we don't have MAP as rule, we have MAP as guidance subject to field adjustments. Therefore, it's possible that we continue to have some amount of electrofishing or other needs to do field adjustments. And so this seems like a best practice item for us if in fact, we need to continue to have a amount of electrofishing that goes on. We probably ought to help the services feel a greater degree of comfort with the risk of take around that. We probably also ought to begin to build the case for the board if it becomes necessary that we can do electrofishing in a way that is least impactful and least extensive too, as part of least impactful. In the event that we choose to seek coverage for that activity. We're not going to obtain coverage for that activity on an ongoing basis for the purposes of the Forest Practices HCP unless we've collected evidence to support that request. Mr. Storm.
Would now be the time to offer a related suggestion?
Sure.
I'm thinking about the conversation we had with Bridget, with the feds, and the lines that are somewhat undefined. I'm thinking about the presentation from the Upper Columbia tribes and the discussion around the use of physicals. And I'm wondering, as I think as we make a choice down the road about how big the electrofish window is or isn't, and what are the other alternatives, I'd like to understand more about not just the comparison of where bankful width lies in the particular stream versus the model. I mean, I think that's important, but I'd also like to understand what are the challenges, what's the efficacy of coming up with standards around the use of that, and that would be both the stream width portion of it as well as the natural barrier portion of it. So just to put some emphasis on there, I'm wondering if in the paragraph 1A where it says and options, we put a little bit of emphasis on the evaluation of efficacy for those physicals. And it could be as simple as what I just said, and options to include the evaluation of the efficacy of using physicals. Just, I think that was going to happen anyway, but I heard that there's some challenges out there, and it's probably just beyond as the number 2 or 2.5 or 3 or 3.6 or whatever. I mean, that would be part of the negotiation, I'm sure, but are there other issues out there about applying that on the ground?
I think that's a great point. I mean, it's been drawn out a bit in the memos to the board that the issues around the physicals, whether they're believed to be accurate or overprotective or underprotective, do seem to vary from an east side application to a west side application. At least it doesn't seem to be quite the issue for the west side that it is on the east side. What I'd say, though, or suggest, is that, you know, as part of number 2, we're trying to look at, you know, whether we can use LIDAR-based data and either teach it to tell us through some different model or some very straightforward exercise how to identify physicals for us based on LIDAR, for the purposes of comparing that against current rule, current model, and then implementation of current rule using FPAs and water tech platforms. And I think if we start to be able to compare those things, even if on a pilot basis, you know, of course choosing watersheds where we think LIDAR is going to work pretty well, then that probably informs us a bit more about where folks' concerns lie in terms of comparing physicals with current rule implementation and model.
So the logic that I hear you going through, Mr. Chair, is that we get a sense of how close we can get with models using LIDAR, and perhaps that causes us to not have to go through the full evaluation of physicals, or
maybe we learn from, if we can apply physicals to LIDAR information and then compare it alongside existing model and FPAs as approved, water tech models as approved, learning the delta between those is not very much, or maybe we learn that it's a lot. And I think we probably want to know that before we sink our teeth into the physicals.
Yeah, I'd like to keep that issue on the table.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously a lot simpler administrative framework for the department.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So let's come back to court's suggestion around the minimizing the electrofishing line, options for reducing the overall extent of surveys use.
In Bridget's first paragraph on the second page, second to last sentence is, protocols that ensure the lowest impact to ESA list of fish, tying in line with the service's accepted direction.
I think maybe let's discuss, rather than deleting that last clause, what if we instead inserted covered species? I don't know if we necessarily want to limit it to list it to ESA listed species. Have an obligation to cover species and APCs, some of which are listed, some of which aren't. And if we
ESA would be cleaner for the services.
Yeah, or we could just say ITP covered species. That's part of the concern, as far as I understand it, as far as implementing that in terms of the promotion. Mm-hmm. And maybe added that after minimizing potential site-specific impacts. I really do think we want to for cost savings purposes and landscape impact purposes, we probably want to look at whether we can reduce the overall use of surveys.
As well as
so that would be an addition, and in A, after the middle clause, it says minimizing potential site-specific impacts, to insert before the comma, to ITP covered species.
I'm sorry, what?
ITP covered species. Incidentally, permanent covered species. Thoughts about that?
I guess where I'm going is, you know, it could be going through the technical committees and policy, and with the service's blessing, it's determined that current electrofishing protocols are okay. So I'd like to leave the language so that it can go either way, that the technical committees and policy are exploring current use and seeing if it is sufficient. So that's where I'm getting at.
So that you don't feel like this leaves the option on the table that, you know.
Well, it's the options for reducing. Options is a good word to have in, but I don't want to lose.
No, it's
yes.
concerned about the meeting. That's okay. Mm-hmm.
But it's just, it has the insinuation that survey use.
That there is an impact that needs to be minimized?
Yeah, or is it minimized already? Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that. I think when the permit holder comes to us and says, you know, we've got a little bit of trouble with how much electric efficiency going on, we can probably go to ourselves and then to have one. That's the thrust.
I don't want to go out
there. Okay. So you want to make an amendment? To incidental take permit covered species to incorporate that?
Sure.
So moved. Motion's been made. Is there a second?
Second.
The motion been made by Mr. Stanley, seconded by Ms. Smith. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Thank you very much. Have we any other substantive issues to discuss on this before we take up the final motion? Mr. Lord.
Yeah, I have a question about the timing here. So, whoever can help me understand this, policy is directed to complete recommendations on permit rule typing sometime, but complete two tasks by May 14th. Mm-hmm. So is that what we really want to do, is just kind of leave that open as to time frame for completing recommendations? Or do we have a reason for waiting on deciding when it should come back?
Do you have a timetable that you'd like the board to consider for completion of a permanent water tank?
May sounds good.
Sounds great.
I'm not really sure what is reasonable. It just seems, you know, it's a sideboard that's missing. I like the idea of having two tasks up front. I mean, this is what we're talking about. These are two, you know, right things to be doing. And I like, you know, how we're talking about it. But I just wonder about the overall charge. Dave was mentioning some aspects of that, and maybe we'll talk after this about that. I think you may be right. We need to get more involved in that particular issue. It just seems a little open-ended.
Yeah, it is. it is recognizing the number of kind of moving pieces that we've got in the picture here. I'm not sure I'd know what to say, you know, when to put an end date on it, and if we did, then we might just come back a couple of weeks from now and change it.
Well, perhaps it would be nice to hear in May some recommendation as to that time frame. Doesn't sure. need to be a part of the motion. It just could be understood that when we get our May report back.
Sure.
We ought to be thinking about that. So yeah.
I thought May was kind of sporty. If policy can do it, mm-hmm. Okay.
We're going to find out, aren't we? Further discussion on the motion as amended?
One more question. $100,000 of support fund, mm-hmm. was that carefully analyzed on exactly cost spending and where it's coming from?
Carefully analyzed from air molecules.
The second one is, does it apply to both Section 1 and Section 2?
One, I don't believe should cost us much of anything. It does apply to 2. It's principally to apply to 2.
Could we leave it open in case we need some money for 1?
Sure. Jim, are you still here? And or Mark, do you think we're going to need any money for 1?
I don't think so.
No?
I think it was intended for 2.
Okay. Well, it does say, you know, enter into contracts as needed to scope and initiate work before May of 2014. So if we encounter something like that, I think that's open enough that it could grow to include additional tasks. And really, this was to get the administrator through the period of time between now and May 18th. So we're requesting a report back and a full work scope at the May
meeting, if we need to make further request adjustments at that time, you know, we'll do that then, but I didn't want to just have us prep a contract and then wait an entire quarter before we, you know, start sending that stuff out into the world to be bid on. Other discussion on the motion as amended? Okay, hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Thank you very much. Fourth piece of business. Took a little bit longer than my usual breakneck pace. I apologize for that, but it was worth the time. Any discussion on this now the motion's approved before we move to the next agenda? Mr. Ward.
Well, Dave brought up the idea that we ought to be trying to make some progress in fish habitat definitions. And I'm not really sure what you might have in mind, but I agree that maybe it is something we need, the board needs to maybe need to decide or get involved in.
This relates, if I can do some agenda management. I mean, this relates to time that the board once spent on technical issues and field tours, and you well recall, Dave, and you've been able to skate by without much of that for the last 7 years, as have most of the other board members. But that's not going to last a whole lot longer because we've got the multi-year effort of mass wasting, which I hope we are able to vote on here today. That board needs to have some fair airtime with an understanding of, because there'll be some implementation steps that are going to be pretty important. The same is true of water tech. We're going to have to go out and familiarize ourselves with it. Yeah, we're going to make you go put your waders on and get y'all a standing
test.
Stand in the stream, and if you float when I shock you.
So maybe it's teeing up that issue for the next board meeting or beforehand, and clearly defining what the issues are, what the different perspectives are, and a couple of alternative ways of looking at it. And at some point, we're going to have to land on it.
Yeah.
And with all the issues we had today, it's hard to tease through them all. And it's starting to get clearer, obviously. But that issue in particular seems to me it's one that we ought to try to focus in some concentrated time on. And I don't know if we do it offline or we do it at the next board meeting, but I think we just ought to get it on the schedule and know that we're going to address it and have a plan leaving here today, because we don't meet for another number of months, and I hate to let that drop because it's a critical issue and needs to be resolved, and if policy can't resolve it, we're going to have to.
Right. So let's for board members and members of the audience, let's all plan on a two-day May board meeting. Other, Joe?
No? Did I say that?
I'm pretty disappointed that our dispute resolution process didn't clarify much. And I just say it to the board, and maybe it's something we can talk about one more time, is that I think we should be thinking through how that process works, because it really should lead to greater clarification. And it seemed like it kind of did the opposite of that, that we had sort of multiple issues unraveling. And there's a, I think we ought to take a look at it. I think the time frames and all that may be just fine, but how we get in, how we define what a dispute is, maybe initially, we may need to take a look at that to make sure that it's properly cooked before it goes into that process, or properly prepared so that there is something to actually be resolved.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that mediation is necessarily the route that we ought to be going.
Or maybe a time for it that is.
Yeah, well, everyone gets a little freaked out by the idea of arbitration, but at the end of arbitration, you have the answer.
Yeah.
Well, I was disappointed when Mary Scurlock said that we couldn't agree on the questions, we couldn't agree on what is fair beforehand, and we couldn't agree on the fundamental issues. If you can't agree on that stuff before you start, what good is arbitration going to be, or mediation going to be? If you go in not not agreeing to anything, you're not going to get anywhere.
I agree. Well, good work by all today on this issue. It's a complicated one. Thank you for your help. Let's move to the public comment period on road maintenance and abandonment planning. Have we any comments or?
Yes.
Thank you. Storm Shaw, please come join us.
Good afternoon again, Chairman Everett and members of the board. I'm Norm Schoff, Timberlands Manager, Vice President for Merrill and Ring. As a large forest landowner, we are have been and are required to submit our road maintenance and abandonment plans for all of our ownership, and we did this by the required date of 2006. We will actually complete our RMAPs work by 2016, as in the initial rule. We will also continue to maintain our roads as long as we need to continue to maintain roads, as long as we continue to use our roads as is required in the rules. The plans that we put together address measures to improve our roads to current standards, to correct any fish passage issues that existed previously, and again, to maintain all of our roads to current forest practices requirements. Our RMAPS plan utilizes the forest practices rules, the board manual, many BMPs, and other techniques that we have developed in order to achieve the objectives within the Forest Practices Act of maintaining roads, making sure that we keep sediment out of streams. The current rules, WAC 222-24051, has many requirements and processes in place that allow the DNR and specify to landowners what is necessary to do to achieve this. The rules already authorize DNR to ask for, to review, and to approve plans, both the RMAPs and supplemental to the RMAPs, for any specific areas of concern. So it's a mystery to me why we're considering additional rulemaking when that authority already exists and when landowners, both small and large, have been following those rules and doing this. You just spent a good bit of time discussing a lot of workload, and so maybe here's an opportunity for you to save a little bit of staff time and certainly a little bit of board time in not engaging in new rulemaking that seems to be unnecessary and redundant. I just fail to see where there's a need for additional rulemaking to occur when the authority already exists in rule. Again, it's WAC 222-24-051, sections 5, C, and D, if you want to look it up, and section 12 and section 14. The authority is already there, and it is being utilized. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Gabu.
Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Godwin with the Weyerhaeuser & Company. Just a couple of comments on this potential rulemaking. Much like Norm, I'm more than willing to work with DNR and others to understand the need. But, you know, quite frankly, when we're done with our RMAP planning process, we're done with RMAPs, and then we move into sort of the maintenance mode. And so, to me, this is sort of like perpetual RMAP liability, and that we've gone through 15 years. We've upgraded these roads. And now we're looking for additional authority to go back and do another plan. And I would prefer that, you know, the deal was the deal. We got the RMAP done. And so then in the future, if we need to do, you know, additional work, it'll occur under the sort of existing authorities we have. But I'm more than willing to entertain the need to see if there are site-specific places where this may be helpful. But I think back to, you mentioned that it may be necessary for big storm damage. After the 2007 storm in Chehalis, our infrastructure was totally devastated, and having to go through sort of another planning process to, you know, upgrade that. It was pretty clear what we had to do, you know, and we were doing work as we could move up the drainage. So I'm just not sure of the application here. I'm more than willing to have a conversation, but I think you have the authority already. And when we finish our maps, we'd just like to move into the maintenance mode instead of having, you know, additional planning requirements if it was needed. Thank you.
Gretchen and Mark, why don't you both join us and tell us why the department is requesting unnecessary work.
Thank you, Chair Everett. Hello, and hello, members of the board. My name is Gretchen Robinson, and I work in the Forest Practices Division in the Policy and Services Section. And my job is on, a lot of my job is on rulemaking and shepherding rules through the rulemaking process. I've asked Mark to sit here because we, ever since my memo went out in your board packet, there have been really good questions and just like comments that you just heard. And my, in my notes, I'm trying to clarify why DNR wants this rule. But I think you'll probably have some very good questions at the end too. That I always ask Mark when I hear the questions, and Mark always gives me the answers, and I would just rather you had it from him, the answers from him. So maybe you won't have any. I don't know. But what I'm requesting is your approval to for staff to file a CR 101 pre-proposal statement of inquiry for an RMAPS clarification rule. And what we might say as the subject line is road maintenance. But the CR 101, I wanted to explain for people that don't understand what that is. It's the first of three rulemaking steps required by the Administrative Procedure Act. There's no rules developed at this point. And an agency files a CR 101 to let the public know that they're considering a rulemaking on a given subject. And they put contact information on the form to let the public know who they should contact in case they want to be involved in the rule development process. So that's where we are in rulemaking, and there's no language developed, obviously. So now that RMAPs are being completed, DNR is looking at the administration of ongoing road maintenance into the future. And as stated in your 2014 work plan, this rulemaking activity is RMAPS clarification. Now, the clarification would be that DNR can work cooperatively with landowners, if they want DNR to, in situations where they are faced with more maintenance work than is feasible to do immediately. Examples might be when there are big weather storms, as we can remember, and it was just brought up recently, the 2007 storm. Maybe there's a ton of work that needs to be done, more than is the usual for issuing enforcement papers on landowners. There, maybe a landowner would like to have a phased approach. Maybe some fixes need to be done immediately, and others can wait in the next 2 or 3 years. So the idea is kind of mini RMAPs for people who need them and want them. So under a scenario like a catastrophic event, or maybe a landowner has acquired property that wasn't under an RMAP to begin with and needs a lot of work, and the DNR sees that there is potential for public resource damage. So in those kinds of situations where the area causing the potential damage to resources is larger than usual for enforcement actions, DNR can require that some work be accomplished immediately, like I said, to stop or prevent the resource damage, and some of the work can be scheduled in a short-term plan. Now, such language existed in the road maintenance section of the rules for many years prior to the current RMAP rules that were adopted in Forest and Fish during Forest and Fish in 2000 and 2001. But it was removed from that section when the RMAP rules were developed in the Forest and Fish rules. So just to summarize the intent of this rulemaking, it comes out of DNR's acknowledgement that the big arm maps that are going on right now and will be completed within the next few years, that maintenance is going to be ongoing, of course, and that unanticipated events can and do happen, and that DNR within its existing enforcement authority can help landowners deal with them cooperatively with cooperative plans. So what DNR has in mind would be to reinsert that short-term planning can occur, and that could happen possibly within the road maintenance WAC. Right now I've heard other ideas like a WAC by itself. It would not affect current RMAP obligations or change public resource protection standards. It would apply to all forest roads under the ownership of large and small forest landowners. It would apply to smaller areas in shorter time frames than the plans under the current RMAPs, than plans under the current RMAP system, the large RMAP plans. And it would clarify that DNR can use a road maintenance planning tool under its enforcement, existing enforcement authority, to work with landowners where they want it and need it to address a large number of road maintenance issues. So of course, what we would do if you approve of us filing the CR101 is solicit the help of stakeholders to develop rule language, and we would probably have a draft ready, or we will have a draft ready prior to your August meeting. So that would be draft rules at your August meeting, and possibly rule adoption in November, the way we have it figured out right now. So please ask questions.
Questions for Mark or Gretchen?
Just to clarify, is this something that would be an optional thing that landowners can take advantage of in certain events, or is this something that would be required?
Mark, I'm going to let you.
It's something that we could require our landowners to take. This is not an extension of the RMAPs. In fact, it really has nothing to do with the current RMAPs rule. And in fact, the RMAP rule, as quoted to the board, or presented the board, is for large landowners. This applies to all landowners. Right now, if a storm event or something occurs, DNR will go out. Our first order of business is to meet with the landowners, and we'll often issue a notice to comply to complete work within a set time frame. But if the work is extensive, say a whole basin, there may be elements addressed in the notice to comply, and then other elements that can be delayed for a year or so. It just offers, it's actually would benefit large landowners, actually all landowners, to address those issues that must be done in order to protect public resources, and then give them time to complete the rest of the work. This is outside of RMAPs. It's assumed that when RMAPs are done, that all the roads are brought up to the current, to the new standards. All new roads built are built to the standards. We have all the confidence in the world that landowners are going to maintain their roads over time. There's no need to ever initiate a road maintenance plan. However, there may be situations, and another one would be Department of Fish and Wildlife. They continue to purchase lands. I forget the name of the program right now, but you're authorized to purchase land. A lot of those are small forest landowner properties where no road work has occurred at all. They may actually purchase outside the normal RMAP window, and they may have to do a lot of work to bring the roads up to standards. This would give an option or an opportunity to work with the DNR to put together, within a reasonable time frame, a plan to bring those roads up to the current standards. So this is in addition to RMAPs. It's not RMAPs on steroids or anything. It's just an opportunity to address issues in the future. We're kind of looking beyond RMAPs.
Other questions? Mr. Storr.
I guess I am a little sensitive to the RMAP fatigue kind of notion that's out there. I mean, so what's the anticipated additional level of effort that the landowners or that the department would have to put forward to make this happen?
it's, first off, it, there's no set number. I mean, hopefully this never happens, although I kind of doubt it. You know, nature tends to do what nature does. So it's working, it's putting together a reasonable, and we don't even have a set timeline in place. It may be 2 years, it could be 3 years, it could be over 6 months. It's just offering the opportunity to, in a orderly way, identify the needs, you know, what work needs to be done, and then kind of set a timing for the completion of the work, a sequencing and a priority order.
I'm still confused, though. I mean, you talked about an orderly way, and then it also sounded like it was episodic.
These would only be initiated when they're needed, and I guess one way you could look at it would be a long-term notice to comply. although I think there are landowners who are sensitive to, also sensitive to getting a lot of, notice to comply is considered enforcement action. This is a way around an enforcement action. Instead, but document a plan in order to complete work to bring roads back up to the forest practices standards.
Along with, I tend to agree with Norm, Mark, that it seems like we already have it in the rule to do that in ongoing road maintenance planning. And so I'm just confused if how it crosses over. That I think we're already covered, or at least I assumed we were.
Large landowners, for the most part, are. Smalls are not at all. So other than the checklist RMAP, and those are associated with harvests. So, and we're thinking of smalls as well. If it's road work beyond what a normal span that a person could initiate all at once, this offers an opportunity to work with them. Again, you're absolutely correct. Large landowners in 051, for the most part, don't need this. There are the obligations associated with 051. We're now thinking in a more global perspective to all forest landowners and all forest roads.
If I could?
Mr. Gunn.
So in the case of the smalls, then, basically what we have right now is if there's an order to bring their roads up to standard, they need to bring that road up to standard immediately. And what you're telling me is then this would give them an opportunity to have their upgrades over a period of time.
It could offer that, yes.
One of the other things I think we're fighting a little bit in the conversation is that this is a 101, an initiation of pre-proposaling for inquiry, and obviously not the ruling, which isn't written. And so we're all sort of wrestling with the need. I'd say that the department, though, has identified an administrative need about, sort of a post-RMAP question and a small forest landowner question. While it does require the expenditure of our staff resources to pull stakeholder group together to figure out what might work or what's really needed, I think that's worth doing. It may be that we get a little ways into that and decide this isn't the perfect timing for it and we don't go to 102. I mean, there's all kinds of different options we'll have to convene the stakeholder group, but I do think it's well to do, and I'm grateful for staff having identified an issue in advance of it becoming a big, hairy problem. So I'd urge board members support of proceeding 101 subject to the process that's going to ensue and everyone's fair judgments about whether it's a thing we really need to do or not. Mr. Wood.
Even though, for the board's benefit, even though Gretchen mentioned a time frame, there really isn't a time frame on a 101, so it could go longer if it's needed.
No, it would be just to fulfill the board's work plan, really, for 2014.
In terms of the other times, but once you file on 102, you do have time frame change.
Yes, you're right.
Further questions, discussion on this issue? Okay, we got a staff recommended motion. Mr. Summers?
On close. I move the Forest Practices Board direct staff to file a CR 101 pre-proposal statement of inquiry to notify the public that the board is considering rulemaking to clarify road maintenance and planning rules.
Have a second. Ms. Bell. Motion's been made and seconded. Discussion on the motion.
Only that I think it's appropriate to flesh this out more, and we'll obviously come back to it before we do a 102, and if there's concerns about it, we can deal with that then.
No, no member sitting up here takes lightly new road maintenance requirements.
Right.
Yes, I'm in agreement with that. As far as if we can, if our stakeholders can take a good look at it and have a voice, then I'll vote for this motion at this time. But the 102, I'll take advice from my constituency. Thank you.
Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Thank you very much. We next have a public comment period on mass wasting effectiveness monitoring project, the otherwise known as the post-mortem study. Hi, Paula.
That's all it took.
Thank you. So we have Cara Whitaker.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. I'm Cara Whitaker, and I'd like to make a few comments on behalf of the Forest and Fish Conservation Caucus. Within the mass wasting subgroup of the Forest and Fish Policy Committee, our caucus had the opportunity to help form the recommendations being presented to you today. These actions represent appropriate next steps in response to the results of the postmortem and other current research to help minimize the occurrence of future landslides due to forest practices. I'd like to highlight a few of the most important recommendations to be implemented to achieve this goal. First, DNR should acquire additional LIDAR-based digital elevation models for improved review of forest practices applications and implementation of the forest practices rules. Second, DNR should develop additional documentation for all forest practice applications involving potentially unstable slopes to increase both the transparency and the thoroughness of slope instability assessments. And third, CMER should prioritize future research of mass wasting, particularly the unstable slope criteria project and the characterization of landslides that don't fit the current criteria for rule-identified landforms. The results of this research may suggest an additional set of policy recommendations in the future. Thank you for doing your part to bring all of the policy recommendations to fruition.
And Cara, I'm aware that you've done a good deal of work for your caucus around the technical elements of the deliberations of policy, and I want you to know that it's not lost on me. I appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Peter Goldman on the list of folks wishing to comment, but I don't see him in the room. So that leaves Karen Terwilliger.
She can speak.
Make sure the minutes reflect when she said, I agree with Peter during the last time we had you up. So.
Well, good afternoon, board members. My name is Karen Terwilliger with WFPA, and I actually agree with Cara. So we're three for three, Mary, Peter, and Cara today. I also wanted to just thank a number of people. One is Adrian Miller for providing leadership in terms of putting this together. He really worked hard in terms of getting the state agencies, the Landowner Caucus, the Conservation Caucus together. I also wanted to thank the Conservation Caucus for working with my folks to come to a solution that works for everybody. So with that, anybody has questions?
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Jim? Yes, sir.
This is the way we like it.
Yes. Yeah. Jim, could you come join us, please, and walk us through the high points of the memo, maybe beginning on page 4 rather than...
Are you in a hurry? That's why you have to go. Sure. I didn't remember my page.
To the top.
We'll start on page 3. I think. You want to start with the process improvement?
I would start with the policy recommendations and actions, actually.
Right.
Start with the motion.
So I want to make sure that I think Cara maybe misspoke. So these aren't recommendations to the board to consider and approve a policy. What these are actions that policy themselves, along with the caucuses represented, that agreed to take. For example, DNR, there's a lot on DNR to do in these recommendations, and that's why I say that the caucuses like also agreed to take.
3A, is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think many of them. Many of the.
Well, was that an example?
Oh, I'm just going to go through. Yes, 3A. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I don't have the same thing you do. I'm speaking to this. So what policy is recommending to the board, based on the results of the study, or disagreement in the results in the analysis and the interpretation, is that the board take no action. So that is the recommendation from policy to the board. The rest is just informing you of what policy themselves chose to do as a result of the study. Okay? And one was, the first thing that they did is recognize that there's a number of improvements that have already been made since the 2007 storm. For example, the board, you went through a year and a half working on the watershed analysis rule, changes in the rule. That was big time. There have been ongoing efforts to improve process improvements with the Forest Practice Apps with respect to mass wasting. Policy supports recommendations for further process improvements, such as investigation assessment of the use of LIDAR for improved screening for unstable slopes and so forth. So you've seen that. I think Aaron's in it. Do you have to go over here?
No, I'm
okay. I just do not. So compliance, one of them, a recommendation or an agreement is to request DNR, and again, it's just a request, that they include an emphasis sample in their compliance monitoring for evaluating compliance with forest practices rules related to mass wasting. There used to be a study in CEMER called the Accuracy and Bias Study that the decision was made a couple years ago, maybe 3 years ago by policy, but that really wasn't an effectiveness or validation study. It was truly a monitoring study, so DNR agreed to take that on. And then going down, another major category was continue current road and forest practices pending further research. And the first one was the policy committee supports implementation and enforcement of the forest practice rules for all new road construction and maintenance, and continued DNR enforcement of deadlines for completion of RMAP requirements. And then with regard to research and monitoring and CEMER, because of the results from the mass wasting study, to do a fairly comprehensive, thorough review of the mass wasting research and monitoring strategy, number one. And then number two, because there were a lot of landslides that occurred out of rural identified landforms, to do a study, what we call the unstable slopes criteria study. Do we have all the criteria we need for determining whether there's potential for a landslide or not? So evaluating the current rules, and do we need new criteria, new rules, new criteria, or whatnot. So that's what policy has agreed to take on, along with its caucuses.
So the nature of the mass wasting study is a little bit unusual in being a non-consensus study from CEMER. So what should maybe folks conclude from that?
Not all scientists are in agreement on how to gather data, analyze the data, and interpret the data.
Very insightful. Thanks.
What else? I think a major lesson. I wasn't around in 2007 when this storm was, when this study was designed. I've gone back and looked at what CEMER notes I could find, policy notes that I could find, and it was pretty clear that not everybody was in agreement over the study design. And you know, what I'm reminded of periodically is that the reason that we have process in CEMER and in policy is that if everybody agrees to the process and you follow the process on through, then everybody ought to agree to what comes out at the end. I think it's the same thing is true for a study. In this case, we didn't have an agreement on all aspects of the study design, but we went ahead with the study design anyway. And I think part of what occurred with this study was not having consensus in the first place on the study design. So lesson number one.
And in spite of that, we have consensus recommendations from policy, which I think is a fairly remarkable thing, given the discussions that have occupied the bulk of our time.
Policy is to be commended. They started on, they developed a, as opposed to type F, I mean, they need to be patted on the back. As opposed to type F, they completed their charter in one meeting, I believe, right? One meeting. Well, they 90% was done, and they tweaked it, and then they got it approved. But basically, the majority of the charter was done in one meeting. They had 6 months to come up with a product, and okay, so we're a month short, but basically they met their six-month deadline. So this, considering how controversial the study was, all the way from the design to finally getting a product policy, as controversial as all of that was, policy was very productive on what to do with this study.
Agreed. Questions from board members for Jim? Lots of glazed over eyes this afternoon. So because policy is not recommending that the board take any action, I suppose we could let this occasion pass without actually having a motion. But that just didn't seem right, given the gravity of the issue.
But a motion would be an action. So.
It would be an action. And so we're disobeying policy, I guess.
Yeah.
Shame on us for that. I think if folks are comfortable enough, knowing that we're going to continue to spend some time sort of debriefing from this issue, I'd like us to move a motion that at least accepts the recommendations of policy and acknowledge it, that the recommendations to the board as far as board action is not to do anything. But I think we would be remiss in not passing a motion, I think, to accept the recommendation.
I move to accept.
Motion's been moved by Mr. Guthrie, seconded by Mr. Summers. Discussion on the motion.
So if you vote against this, then we're going with policy.
Then you're going to have a five-day meeting.
I'm convinced.
Mr. Guthrie, would you please read the motion?
I move the Forest Practices Board accept the Timber Fish and Wildlife Policy Committee's recommendation to take no action at this time on the mass wasting effectiveness monitoring project and examination of the landslide response to the December 2007 storm in Southwest Washington.
Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Thank you very much. We are on to our final item of business. Mark, would you come join us, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Final action or final agenda item today is that the board received another petition for rulemaking for the Western Gray Squirrel. I'll make this very brief. So the board did receive on January 28th the petition. The petition does not offer any additional information from the petition that was presented to the board for consideration at the board's November meeting. I'd like to remind you that the board did request, and it has been placed on the board's work plan, that DNR and Wildlife present to the board at your May meeting a status report on the voluntary landowner plans to protect the habitat of the Western Gray Squirrel. With that being said, I also remind the board that you must no later than 60 days after receipt of the complete petition, which is by March 29th of this year, you need to initiate rulemaking proceedings in accordance with the APA or deny the petition in writing, stating the reasons for denial and specifically addressing the concerns stated in the petition.
Thanks, Mark. Board members have had a chance to review the petition. We've spent a great deal of time on this issue over the last year. I'm going to go around the table, and I think the main question is whether individual board members believe that the petition before us presents any new information from those that we've considered in the past. And let's start with Mr. Herrera.
Thank you. I don't see any new information that, I guess, in the petition, if that's the question.
That's the question.
You said we've talked about this at length, and my comment last time it was in the minutes was that I believe our WDFW is, they have a program that supposed to be protective of gray squirrel habitat. They reported at the last meeting, and they said they feel like that voluntary program is currently working. I think I heard Joe Storr this morning mention further. We're going to take a further, closer look at that, and so I think at this point, I don't know if you're asking if I think I need to. We should entertain rulemaking on this. I think we should wait to hear back what WDFW is doing. I think in May, maybe we'll get a report and go from there.
Ms. Smith?
I don't think that there's any new information. Fourth petition we received. I think we've made some sort of effort to retrieve information after everyone, and Joe this morning said what their numbers were since December. You can't start on another petition when we don't even have the last one finished. So at this point, I see no reason to act on this.
Mr. Litter.
I agree with what David Herrera just said. I think it's up to Fish and Wildlife if they can show that the gray squirrel is declining, then they will bring it to us.
Very well. Mr. Cook?
See no new information. I see no reason to act.
Where's the... Mr. Laurie?
And I think we're on the right course here. That is, having the WDFW take a closer look at this. I appreciated the update this morning from Joe and from Terry on activities that you're already doing. So I think we're on the right time frame, and we're taking a prudent action, and I don't think it's time for a petition or for rulemaking on this yet.
Agreed. I think your report was excellent. Showed a lot of progress, and it left me fairly comfortable that we're in a good spot right now. So I see no reason to go forward.
Mr. Storr.
Yeah, I'm just trying, with the report this morning, I'm just trying to keep everybody in the loop in terms of the commitments we made and the voluntary approach that we decided on, months back, and I think we are making some progress there. I think the question that's before all of us is, in some places and in some ways is what's happening to the squirrel, and then beyond that, what's causing that to happen, whatever that is. And I'm not, don't think I could promise you all those answers by the next meeting, but we are moving forward and looking harder at this population and trying to do what we can within the authorities that we have, and I'll keep you informed.
Thanks. This is Val.
I also did not see any new information in the most recent petition, and I really appreciate the Fish and Wildlife's work on making commitments to follow up on this. And the work they've done so far to do that, and look forward to further reports as to whether we would need to take action or not.
Well, I appreciate Mr. Kavanaugh's persistence, and I think that, you know, he's brought to light the plight of the western gray squirrel, and I believe that we should continue the path that we have taken, and I don't see new information at this point in time, but I do, again, appreciate his concern for the western gray squirrel.
Mr. Sommer.
Well, I agree with those comments also, and whatever the other comments that have been made. I don't see new information, but I do think we need to continue to gather information and take action when appropriate. But absent some urgency by or direction from the department that's looking at this, it's a little difficult to move forward. So, thank you.
Thank you. With that, I
think
I'd entertain a motion on this petition since we need to take action on it here today. And do I have a member willing to make such a motion?
I'll make the motion.
Motion's been made by Mr. Little. I have a second.
Seconded.
Seconded by Ms. Smith. Read the motion, please.
I move the Forest Practices Board deny the petition for rulemaking on the Western Gray Squirrel received on January 28, 2014.
Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Thank you all very much. That is our last item of regular business. Bill, do we have any reason to proceed to the executive session?
Not bad.
And without objection, we stand adjourned. Good day's work, everybody. Thank you.
I wouldn't call it public attention right now.
I've got an idea for you.
For me?
Yes.
Uh-oh. Just,
you know, the guy is persistent.
Yeah, he's passionate. You know, and then he's a problem.
Well, we can shut down everything.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I still
have that. It's just like this survey and all this C101 for the small forest landowners. Now they got a chance to wait.
Yeah. No. Might as well talk about it. Plug it out. It sounds like it might be a piece of tool.
It might be a tool.
If it gets into a longer implementation period, you know, right now they just have another slide.
Down and they, you know, they've about $500,000 worth of timber, and they've got $250,000 worth of roadwork to do anyway.